Access number 286533, Mr. Francis Lucas, Reel 4. Now, so where were you posted to when you... I mean, that was the end of the course. You are now a company quartermaster sergeant, foreman of signals,
yes,
in the Royal Corps of Signals. And where were you posted to next?
My posting then was to the 22nd Army Brigade of the 7th Armored Division. And we were sent down to the Guildford area. And they were really assembling and training our unit in this Guildford area. And that worked out in a way very well for me, because it was, again, convenient pretty well to our home area.
Now, were you actually you went to Hascombe? Is that near Guildford? I'm not.
Yes. Hascombe would be a few miles from Guildford,
and
our unit assembled in an old country house area on the outskirts of Hascombe, and gradually the various sections of the unit came together there in Hascombe.
Now, this is the whole of the 22nd Armoured Brigade, I presume?
The whole of the signals section.
Now, was the signals called anything? Was it just called the signals section, or was it... Do you have another name?
Yes, the Armoured Brigade Signals. The Armoured Brigade Signals.
And what was the composition of the Armoured Brigade signals?
It would be the Headquarters Signals Unit, which I found myself in charge, and that was responsible for the training of the various lads who made up the unit. And so one soon became involved again in lecturing and getting material together, and again the setting up of your workshop area, the mobile workshop, fitting out workshop trucks. We were supplied with trucks that were, of course, just empty trucks, most of them from America, 3-ton trucks, and you had to fit them out as effective workshop units.
Now, how many? I want to work through some of this. How many were you training? What was the composition of the Armoured Brigade? Were you the whole Armoured Brigade Signals, or was it divided up into bits?
No, we were the whole Headquarters Armoured Brigade Signals. We had sections, of course, that went with the various units, but we were the core centre.
Now, what? How many were you training? What was the composition of the headquarters?
The composition of the headquarters would consist, the headquarters unit itself, consist of approximately 50 personnel, I would judge, right about 50, who you subdivided into groups, in particular according to their ability and so on. You'll appreciate that there were the ancillary units for provisions and goodness knows what, but this was the technical side, where you trained the lads in radio communication, in familiarization with the equipment they were going to have, with the type of communication equipment installed in the tanks, and installed headquarters, etc. So it was a matter of becoming thoroughly familiar with both the use and the maintenance of that equipment.
Now, who was helping you in this training role, or were you doing it mainly yourself?
Amazingly, you were just thrown into it. Looking back, that does amaze me. There was very little outside help. You had your objectives, you had your equipment, and to a great extent it depended upon you and those who you recruited around you to build yourself into an effective communication unit, a maintenance unit. I'm amazed looking back, but it was put in your lap.
Now, what was you were making? You were setting up mobile workshops and training
right.
the men to use them.
Now, exactly.
What exactly would you? You've told me what the mobile workshops were. These vans or lorries, whatever. You know, but what would you put? How would you make a lorry into a mobile workshop? What equipment would you put into it?
Well, first of all, of course, you would fit it out with the workshop. Desks and sections there. You would wire out your lorry so that you had power outlets conveniently available at the sections of the workshop. You would be requisitioning from the quartermaster things like measurement meters and normal tools, etc., tool kits, etc., and supplies of spares, of valves, of other equipment. So you had to decide yourself what you needed and what you would need as spares. Looking back, I'm amazed that there was no general direction. And in point of fact, the other units that were similarly formed, of course, may have done so on quite a different basis. It was very, very much a personal matter. But it was a tremendous challenge, and you were able to use your initiative. And that, quite frankly, I enjoyed very much. And we had some very, very good lads who were devoted to the work and really... they put their backs into it.
So what sort of equipment did you decide to carry with you?
Basically, of course, diagnostic and measurement equipment was
now,
the basis of it.
What was the diagnostic and measuring equipment of the day? Because people now just can't imagine.
Yes.
100 years in the future, they won't believe it. What did you use for
Absolutely.
Diagnostics?
The basic thing was the avometer. Now, the avometer was a multi-purpose meter that was generally used in radio service shops and so on, and it was very, very reliable. So you had to be sure that you had a basic number of avometers.
How do you spell that?
A-V-O, avometers.
And what did that tell you?
That could tell you just about all you wanted to know, because it was a multi-measurement piece of equipment and would be able to measure, of course, volts, current, amps, resistance, and all the basic electrical formulae you could work out on the avometer. So it was the main thing. And of course, in addition to that, you would have your construction equipment, your soldering irons, your vices, your whole range of working tools, etc., your basic materials of wire, solder, goodness knows what, everything you found you needed in a typical business workshop.
So, any other diagnostic or measuring equipment, or was that really just the avometer that did for everything?
That was the main equipment. Absolutely.
What other equipment would you have?
As far as other equipment was concerned, strangely enough, in that day, there wasn't a great deal of anything else.
You had
no oscillographs or things of that nature, which would be the basics today. And so your basic meter gave you the details of the resistance and circuitry and so on. And then you had to apply, okay, where is the fault from that? It was not possible. You didn't have equipment that you could plug in, press a few buttons, and see on the screen what was happening. Such things were unknown. They were not around.
So this AVO meter was your basic tool, and then you carried the rest of the stuff you carried was sort of the soldering kit, the stores, the
right.
wires, the bits and bobs, the valves, I presume.
Exactly. Yes. And so you just use your initiative to a great extent. And some of the lads were just wonderful at that. By that time, you got
would
the
would you carry batteries as well?
Oh, yes, yes. Yes, a whole range of batteries for the radios, set of the portable radios, in the tanks and so on. Of course, it worked off of the tank power supply, etc.
Would you have a generator or a battery
yes,
generator?
Yes, there was available motor generator as part of the unit, which was required for charging tank batteries when, for whatever reason, they need additional charging.
Was there a big problem in, I presume you needed a lot of spare valves. Or were there many valves, different types of valves, or were they all just the same?
The standard set used in the tank was the number 19 set. And the number 19 set had, if memory serves me right, about 12 or 14 valves in that set. Then there was the...
And were they all the same? Or were they different?
No. They were about three distinct varieties. And then you had the portable set, the shoulder carried one, which was the number 19 set. That, of course, had its own separate batteries, etc.
I thought you said the 19 was the one in the tank.
Oh, I'm sorry. 19 is one in the tank. Number 18 was a portable one, which lads would carry, those who had to would carry them on their back for local communication, etc.
So... Now, these valves, you had to keep a stock of valves, therefore.
Oh, absolutely.
But they're
essential.
Pretty fragile. Was there any special storage method?
Well, strangely enough, not as fragile as you would think. No.
So they didn't have to be wrapped in cotton wool or anything?
No. They were held in containers where they were plugged in, etc. And apart from that, no, they would stand quite a bit of knocking about, amazingly.
Now, yeah. What did you, as you're sort of getting there, what did you think of the 19 wireless set? It's a very famous set. The British Army used it for years.
That's right.
In the 50s. What did you think of the, speaking as a fairly newly qualified chap, you arrive there, there's the 19 set, it's 1941. What did you think of it?
Brilliant.
And what was so
about the brilliant about the ultimate of technology of as of that time?
Now, what was so good about it? If you can take me through it, the basic how you operated it.
Yes.
That might be difficult, but just what you remember of it and why it was so good.
What I remember of it is the fact, first of all, it was very compact and self-contained, that it slipped in and out easily to its outer container where it would be fitted into the tank or into whatever. The circuitry was complex in as much as it coped for two forms of transmission and reception. It had short distance, which was in its infancy then, short distance reception and transmission, and long distance, which was the main thing. And it would be in the tank, would stick all the vibration of the tank, and give, under normal conditions, incredible, reliable communication.
What range?
That would depend entirely upon the terrain, and so on, under suitable terrain conditions, I suppose the range could be 8-9 miles, about 8 or 9 miles.
Now, how reliable was it? I mean,
yeah, extremely
in use. You know, not theoretical on a desk. You know,
right.
I mean, in a tank.
Depend entirely on the operator. Depend too, of course, on the location of the tank, where the tank was in relation to the conforming countryside around, because if you had dense woodland or hills, those days that would affect transmission very considerably. So judged by today's results, it would be regarded as being very, very basic. But in the context, you have to remember, in the context of the 1940s, that was a very different situation. It was advanced.
Well, when I said reliable, I meant more, would it keep going? Not whether it would, you know, I mean, was it liable to failure? As it just didn't work electrically?
No, really, they were very reliable. We always carried a stock, not only of spares, but a stock of the actual sets themselves, two or three on each truck. But the reliability, I would judge, was of a very acceptable standard.
What was the usual thing that would go wrong?
Oh, chiefly valves.
What causes valves to go wrong? People won't know. I mean.
Ah, yes. Well, a thermionic valve is quite, shall I say, a basic thing, more or less like a very complex light bulb, you might say, with a very complex set of technology inside it. And really, vibration would be the one thing which in due course would affect many of them. And of course, in a tank, they were subject to vibration.
Now, what about the 18 wireless set? What did you think of that as a set? Or was it just very similar to the 19, except smaller and portable?
No. 19 was very basic. I'm mixing the types again.
The 19 is the wireless set that goes in the vehicles. That's definitely the thing. I don't know whether it's 18 or 88, the number of the portable.
Portable, I think, is 18, isn't it? Yeah.
And what was that like? How did it compare to the 19?
Well, it was very, very basic, very, very simple. And because of that, very, very, as I remember it, very, very reliable. It was also much more disposable. And so what would often happen, if one was giving any great trouble, someone would just dump it in a ditch, and that would be that, and make some excuse as to why they have lost it, etc. And, of course, very much cheaper to produce, and so on, than number 19.
And a smaller range.
Yes, indeed. A very much smaller range, sometimes limited to a few hundred yards. But it was essential.
So those are any other basic communications things that the 22nd Armoured Brigade had? You've got the 19 set, the 18 set, anything else? So any teleprinters or anything like that?
Oh, my goodness, no. Although teleprinters were, of course, used in civilian communication centres, we would not have them, and they would be impossible under service conditions.
So now, you settle in at Hascombe in near Guildford, or near East
Guildford.
Yes,
indeed.
Now, how does the process go on? You're training people, yes. You're actually putting together the lorries, which
is a
difficult business. Anything else about that? We'll come to the religious side, because I think we'll always keep tabs on that. But
oh, yeah, sure.
But anything else military you're doing?
At the same time, there was still a reasonable, and I would say essential, basic discipline. Different in a way, inasmuch as your discipline had to be linked to the efficiency of the work you were doing. In other words, the technical work you were doing really took precedence over parades and what have you. But nevertheless, the parades were still there and were still essential, in my opinion, in keeping you as a cohesive, active army unit.
Yeah.
You were still... You see, the lads tended to be individualists, very much so, in their job. But they're still in the army. And overall discipline just had to be maintained.
Now, and part of your job would be to make, as CQMS, would be, I presume, to maintain...
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Now, you hadn't had much experience of taking parades. Had they taught you? I should
have
asked
them. Fortunately, you just didn't have to take parades. There's a sergeant major there who would do that. And boy, he always maintained his authority. The great thing was to endeavour in the informal time to get on with the sergeant major, to get to know him.
Now, how did you get? Do you remember yours?
I do indeed.
He'd be a company sergeant major or
yes,
a warrant officer?
CQMS. Well, company sergeant major.
Company.
Yeah, that's right.
And what was he like?
We had several. They varied. They varied a lot. Some were very, very authoritative and knew very little beyond basic discipline and making you march and stand at attention in a certain way. There were others who, particularly off duty, were not nearly as tough and quite friendly and will have a friendly word with you about some problem. So there were the whole run of them, you know.
And what about your officers? I presume you had a signal officer.
Yes, we did indeed. Over my whole experience, we...
Was there more than one or just...
With a number of them. They tended to keep clear of you simply because there was rarely, quite frankly, a signals officer, usually... lieutenants or second lieutenants who had any clue at all about what you're doing. And so they tended to avoid getting too involved with it. As long as you seem to be producing results which they could accept overall credit for, that was fair enough. And I never had any problem.
Their job would be more with the signalers. You were the repair section.
That's right.
And
yes,
they'd be dealing more with the people sending out the signals.
Exactly.
And liaising,
yes,
with the signals.
Yes, yes. That's true. Very interesting, that relationship.
Now, what about anything else that was going on at Haskell? I'm not sure how long you were there.
I'm not sure either. A matter of a few months. Long enough, again, to get integrated with the local people.
Well, and for you, that is normally a religious relationship. Well, not religious, but, you know, based on
Mutual
faith.
Yes.
Now, tell us a bit about... We are interested in... Because it's quite unusual to have a chap at that age was so involved in religion and that community, you know, their local communities. How did you develop a relationship with the local religious community in Haskell?
Well, in a very strange and casual way. The place we were based at was actually a few miles out of Haskell, and one would travel on the bus when you wanted to go into Haskell, which you quite frequently did. And it all started off like this. I was on the bus coming back from, let me see, what is the place? Oh, dear me. I'm just trying to think of the
Godalming. Godalming.
Yes, Godalming.
That's how you pronounce it. Yes, that's of course it is.
I was on the bus coming back from Godalming. I was sitting, I remember, on the back seat. I had a Bible in my hand, and I just idly turned the pages. As it came into Hascombe, a young girl, a very vivacious-looking girl, jumped off the bus and just casually noticed me. 3 or 4 days later, there was inquiry made. I forget exactly how this worked out, but there's inquiry made which did establish a contact, and I was asked to contact the local post office. What it boiled down to, in the local post office, the family of this girl were churchgoers and Christians. She apparently went in and said, "Oh, look, I think there's a fellow in the local unit here who must be a Christian, because I certainly jumped off the bus. I saw he had a Bible with him." And I forget how, but they eventually made contact with me. To cut a long story short, they were wonderfully generous people. They opened their home to me. Dillis, my young bride, my young wife, was able to come up to Hascombe and stay with the post office. I got a sleeping out pass and became almost a member of the family. And I have the warmest regards of them. And, of course, the contacts remain to this very day. It's astounding.
Now, one thing I noticed, I've just been looking at your notes, is that one of the reasons they'd spotted you as a Christian is that there have been reports that you didn't like swearing in your workshops.
Oh yes.
tell me about that, because that's interesting, because now you can actually, I mean, before, when you're a recruit, you can't stop anyone swearing. But did you actually act, is that real? Did you act to stop people swearing, or did you, is it just...
Well, no, rather amusing, really. I mean, I just did not swear, and that was it. But apparently, it seems, and from comments I had after, he didn't swear, but boy, don't get on the wrong end of his tongue. And so it seems that I was able to exercise authority all right, just as strongly as if I cursed them upstairs and downstairs, and etc. And to my great surprise, and I comment about this in one of the other things I've written, to my great surprise, I was regarded, apparently, as being remarkably tough, but I didn't realise it. I knew I had to get a job done. I enjoyed getting the job done. And if folk didn't jump to it, I told them. But I didn't find the need to swear.
And anything else happened while you were in Hascombe?
No. Apart from friends I made there, and my wife coming down, I can't think of anything specific.
Now, do you know when you came to leave? Because the 22nd Armoured Brigade sailed, don't they? Is it May 1941?
It would be, right about that date. Yes.
No, hang on.
Is it? I don't
know.
No,
I think that's just when this is dated. No, it must be later than that. You're not quite sure.
Oh, yes, I remember, of course. We went from Hascombe as now a complete train unit, and we went down to the Brighton area. And we're down in the Brighton area.
Now, when did you do that?
For a while. Again, we're accommodated down there. Not sure how long we
were. Was it Brighton or Hove?
Well, the whole Brighton and Hove area, the whole of that coast along there. From
and what
Brighton,
were you doing
Hove
there?
Along the coast. We were simply there, getting together, waiting, as we now knew, to go up to the port, to the docks, and embark. We were expecting to move any time there. But in point of fact, we were there for quite a number of weeks, and I remember over the Christmas period. And again, I was so fortunate, it's possible for my wife, Dillis, to come down and stay with very friendly people over the Christmas period.
And so you left in, what, January?
It would have been, I think, in January, yes, after an inspection by His Majesty the King, etc.